We are the music makers, and we are the dreamers of dreams.
Television is reality, and reality is less than television. All necessities provided, all anxieties tranquilized, all boredom amused.
Feature presentation, The Pause Button, with your host, Borzoi Boskovich.
Sometimes I doubt your commitment to The Pause Button, and I am your host, Borzoi Boskovich, and this week we're talking about Southland Tales specifically, but my guest had some particular thoughts about that movie.
Just want you to know we've made it through I don't know how much of this movie, and I'm going to fucking kill you. I'm going to kill you. Because I'm going to see you. I'm going to have a Jeep transform into a big robotic dildo, and it's going to rape you to death.
Yes, I have Alex McNabb joining me this week.
Yeah, sorry. Like, I'm not a huge David Lynch fan, and this was like David Lynch on a lot of drugs and like times 20.
And not just Alex McNabb, but we also have Morris Punchard. Hello, Morris.
Hey, this is Morris Punchard speaking. You can actually hear my laugh in that little little clip that you just played. I'm laughing in
the background. You don't understand, man. Like, we were sitting there watching Southland Tales, and I was like, man, we need drugs. Like anything, please, dear God. Like, yeah. We had, like, rum, and that was it.
We'll get to that, but do you guys have anything you want to plug, besides TDS, obviously, but anything particular you guys want to plug in this episode?
Well, my show, I had a show, Press F from my former show, DBLS 88. That's Diabolos 88, all caps, no vowels. We were the first, best, and only Nazgoth podcast, and I think our archives are still around. You can Google them.
I did a voice clip for you guys once, as I recall.
You played Satan himself, if I remember correctly.
Yes, I did.
You bargained with Moon Man for his head in a box that also contained a genie played by Alex McNabb.
So. See, like, we're talking about Southland Tales, like, needing drugs to understand. Like, I think we need drugs to understand, like, half the shit we were doing back then.
Dude, no, I disagree. I completely disagree. I think that, like, the plots they were doing were far simpler. I mean, we have a new show now. It's Star Trek and Cycling. That's, I guess, what we're doing now.
But, I think we can't really talk about Southland Tales, though, unless we first talk about Richard Kelly's first work, Donnie Darko, because a lot of the problems that are in Southland Tales are kind of endemic to, everything that is in Southland Tales, you can find its roots in Donnie Darko and the success of Donnie Darko. So let's talk about the cult classic movie Donnie Darko first.
Obviously, we want to start with, like, the cultural context of Donnie Darko, and there's, like, a lot to unpack there. I guess let's let Borzoi go first, his experience of Donnie Darko.
So Donnie Darko was actually, like, my favorite movie when I was, we'll just say when I was a teen, basically. That movie, I'm trying to remember when the exact year it came out. That was like an early 2000s movie, because I remember watching
2001.
2001, yeah. And I was obsessed with that movie. And a lot of people were at that time. And this is one of the reasons why, in order to talk about Southland Tales, you have to talk about Donnie Darko, because if there's any, those movies, well, particularly Donnie Darko, like, they tend to really, I think, exemplify the climate of the aughts. Like, the funny thing is, they don't really have any cultural, like, the movies themselves are not culturally connected to that time period, but the feelings that they evoke and the connections that people, like, had to that movie, particular Donnie Darko, like, is very emblematic of those aughts. It was this movie about, like, it had a little bit of everything, basically. You had this, like, family drama, you had, like, things about, like, depression and mental illness, you had science fiction in it, you had, like, this puzzling element to it. There's a style to it. There was something that was very evocative of the past. Because like that was when 80s nostalgia was really starting to get in. Like we were talking about this before the show, Alex, but this was Stranger Things before there was Stranger Things.
Yeah, I honestly think this may have been like the first 80s nostalgia film that, like, I remember seeing reviews at the time. They were talking about how it was unusual. It shows like the 1980s, especially 1988, hey, like meme time, whatever. But yeah, so your experience, I guess you're a little bit younger than me. I was late teens, early 20s. I was in a college town. I was dating this chick, and she introduced me to the film. And of course, she was a huge Tim Burton fan, and she had Incubus posters all over her dorm room. So you can kind of like understand that kind of culture. And I was like, "Oh, we gotta see like Donnie Darko." And I remember watching it and liking it. Like it was interesting. But like this was a time period in that culture where every college girl had Incubus posters. It was like huge in that band. The Tim Burton type stuff, like just this general,
yeah.
Like early 2000s, like
Invader Zim.
Yay! Yes. No. Oh my God! Yes. Invader Zim. Holy shit!
Gargoyles.
Yeah. I don't know about the gargoyles. Invader Zim was everywhere, though. Yeah, no, that's true.
Yeah, like Jonan Vasquez was the creator. Like it wasn't just like Invader Zim, but like his other comics, like Squee and the like. Those girls all liked that stuff.
Yeah. That was like you still had like the tail end of like the goth culture before it, I guess, evaporated. Yeah, that was like my exposure. I remember watching it and I remember enjoying the film, but not being like terribly moved by it, you know, or sucked into it. I actually rewatching it, I found it much more interesting.
Yeah, I think then that explains kind of like our contrasting reactions on it, because rewatching it, I still enjoyed the movie, but because I had been so obsessed with it when I was younger and then hadn't seen it again in like, I think like nearly 10 years, I came away not liking it as much, but being much more cognizant of what it was about it that I don't like. And it's the same elements I didn't like about Southland Tales, basically. Cause like, I think what works about it, and this is why I made the Stranger Things kind of like comparison. What I liked about it was the, like it being a period piece, and that there's something strange going on, but it's the human drama that's so much more interesting about the movie. None of the like that time travel stuff, I think, is kind of like is actually a lot more cumbersome, and that's a big focus on in the director's cut, which I like. This movie was an example of where editing made this movie better.
The time travel explanation really does not work because of who Frank is and what you see Frank do in the plot. Like Frank does not behave like a pure time traveler. He behaves like someone who's outside of time.
Mm-hmm.
And that whole thing, all that shit doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
But in the end, I think it adds to kind of the charm of the picture because, you know, it's mysterious and it gives you something to talk about with your friends after you've seen it.
Yeah, well, it's just like with the whole Force from Star Wars, because in the originals, like a lot of the more like don't explain it too much. It's more like a vague mystical forcing. A lot of that came from Gary Kurtz who told who was basing it more on his Mormon faith, like to make it more of a religious component. And then under Lucas's hands, like he had to go ahead and try to explain with midichlorians and all that. Like he tried to give it more of a thorough explanation. Like you have a similar thing going on with Donnie Darko if you compare the theatrical cut and the director's cut, because the theatrical cut the director's cut it tries to explain it much more thoroughly, and they. And that's actually, like, I remember on that director's cut, there used to be a documentary about, like, the super fan who was so obsessed with it, and, like, he tried to understand every bit of it, and it was one of the cringiest things I'd seen. Like, they made it, like, it kind of as a joke about him, but, like, that's also the, like, that it kind of is encapsulates the problem of Richard Kelly and his works, is that that's the stuff he gets into, and that's the kind of people he attracts, and he tends to miss the broader point unless somebody's there to pull him aside and basically, like, take what he made and try to pare it down to something much more manageable and much more expository, basically.
So can you explain a little bit about the director's cut? I've never seen that version of the film. Like, what is it exactly adding to the like original picture?
It adds a bunch of scenes, and the thing is it basically just makes everything a bit more explicit. Like, that's what takes, like, because that was the charm of Donnie Darko. For people who don't remember who weren't either don't remember this or weren't around in this time period when Donnie Darko became a cult film. It came out in 2001, but it wasn't a hit. Like, it did well on DVD basically, and this was in the early aughts. That's like when DVDs were really got big, and that was one of those like among teens, like especially in like high school, that was like the must have kind of DVD. Like, this is the one like that the art kids and the goth kids and whatnot would pass around and say, like, you need to check this movie out. And it's because of like that, there's like a lot of the stuff is not explained and there's something mysterious about this. And you got like, and then like the demonic bunny of Frank was a big draw. Like, that was the big draw to it. Like, when you tried to explain this movie to your friends to get them interested in it, you tell them about the demonic bunny.
Why are you wearing that man suit? Like,
oh my, we'll get to that line in a second.
But yeah, like, so it's kind of funny. Like,
you were asking about, like, I just want to finish the point of this. So because of that, like, that popularity making it into a cult hit allowed it to get a re-release in theaters and a direct with the director's cut. And on that director's cut, which has a, cause like this became a minor cultural phenomenon, like Kevin Smith, this is how Kevin Smith became friends with Richard Kelly, and he appears on Richard Kelly's director's commentary, and they have like a couple, like they have all kinds of stuff, like they have a couple commentaries on there, and they have all the scenes restored and some of the things that are in it. First, you have a bunch of more scenes that like could have easily been taken out, because like they just kind of pad the movie. Like, there's one scene where they're watching Watership Down, which was cut from the original, from the theatrical cut. But they also have they have like interposed on the screen, like pages from The Philosophy of Time Travel, which try to explain it more explicitly. But the main thing, like, which this is one of those things where like sometimes it's better to just like not go with your original vision if the new cut of it just makes it work better, is that the soundtrack has changed around, because now that they have the money, they can get the rights for, because Kelly had an original vision that he couldn't pursue for the movie. The director's cut allowed them to restore that. And one of them, like, he films his movies to a soundtrack that's in his head. And in that opening scene when Donnie is bicycling home after he wakes up mysteriously outside, that was supposed to go to an In Excess song, and I forget what song it was.
Oh man.
But that they went with Killing Moon by Echo and the Bunnymen because they couldn't get In Excess, and that song worked so much better for the opening. Like, it did.
Like, I think to Morris, like,
yeah,
I have that song like as part of my cycling playlist, and it's from Donnie Darko. And yeah. I was like ashamed to admit it. I was like, yeah, I got this Echo of the Bunnyman song. Yeah, that's from Donnie Darko, dude. Okay,
well, I like the Tears for Fears song. Like, it's not a
yeah. Well, that's like this is what I mean. Like, this, if people weren't around for the time period when this movie was a cultural phenomenon, like that Mad World, that cover, the Gary Jules version of Mad World, that was made popular by Donnie Darko. That's where that song was discovered by people, was in Donnie Darko.
At least in our generation,
for sure. Well, yeah. Well, the Gary, I mean, how old is the Gary Jules version of it?
The original?
No, it's not, because like it's not like, no, it's the cover. Like, the Gary Jules cover.
The cover was made for the movie, I'm pretty sure, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's what I mean. Like, that's how much of a cultural phenomenon this movie was. Like, that, because like that, when people hear like nowadays, like a lot of people found that song Mad World through an advertisement for Gears of War, but that all started with Donnie Darko.
That game sucks, man. I played Gears of War.
But the commercial campaign for it was well known, and it brought that song to another. It was done specifically, I think, for the soundtrack of Donnie Darko. That Gary Jules version of it.
Yeah, I mean, it was a great soundtrack in general, and I didn't even know that Tears for Fears did like the original. Like, I had no idea. Like, that's what a plebe I am. I literally did not know. Until like Morris, like, oh yeah, it's Tears for Fears song. I'm like, oh god.
That's actually what makes Donnie Darko such a fascinating film to really watch, because like, and why people had high hopes for Richard Kelly was because he had his finger on some kind of cultural pulse. He was like, he was tapping into something that was,
I mean,
like, go ahead.
Society posting, right?
Yeah,
you know, he was society posting pretty hard, and
that bunny man.
In my notes here, I got little notes. The critiques of psychological models of pedagogy and moral emotivism. So you have, you know, the kind of the fear love dichotomy, which is really stupid, which we've all had to sit through if we've all had to go to like a you know, a school counselor, you know, has tried to explain something very much like that to us. I don't think that he offers any real solution to that problem. He's just like, oh, well, yeah, people think stupid things. Teachers and various people in our society think stupid things, and, you know, what are you going to do?
John Fowle's first book was called he was a British writer for people who aren't familiar with him. He's more famous for the what's it called? The French Lieutenant's Lover?
I think Lieutenant's Woman?
Woman, the French Lieutenant's Woman, yes. Yeah. But his first novel is called the Magus or the Magus, and he kind of disavowed that novel later in life, and he has this very famous foreword that he wrote for a later edition of the book that basically, like, he says something to the effect of, it must fundamentally remain an adolescent novel written by a retarded adolescent. And that's kind of how, like, and that's like, because Donnie Darko is very much like a movie, like, you know, it has moments of like, I'm 13 and this is deep, like, and you called out, like, kind of one, yeah. Like, why are you wearing that stupid bunny suit? Why are you wearing that human suit? It's like, whoa!
The director was like 23 at the time.
Yeah, no, it's like, and that's like
unheard of, isn't it? It's like pretty rare to have a
director. Well, and that's going to later lead into Southland Tales, because, like, he later said after the fact, it's like, nobody should ever make a movie before the 30, because, like, that's like, he was given so much praise for, like, what, like, for this, for Donnie Darko, that he was basically allowed to do whatever he wanted for Southland Tales.
He was given so much praise that, like, he turned down X-Men 2. Like, they offered him a director's position on that film, and he's like, nah. I want to do Southland Tales.
Yeah, which was his passion project, and nobody, like, well, I don't think even people knew how to tell him no on that, because, like, that was such an incomprehensible project to most people. Like, I understand that adolescent mindset, because he was coming at this from somebody who's like, he was that kid who's like, I'm gonna read all the weird stuff. Like, I'm gonna look for all the stuff that nobody else my age is reading or doing, and I'm gonna, like, get deeply into that. I want to incorporate every bit of that into everything I do and make. Like, I understand that mindset 100% because I was that guy.
Yeah,
well, and I know how obnoxious it is. I know how much it needs to be reined in.
There's a thing too, like, Jewish movie producers, I mean, just coincidental, whatever, but, like, they will tend to take these directors and make them do sequels to previously effective films and do, like, sequel after sequel and grind away, and then finally they'll let them do, like, their passion project. But that's, yeah, like, after, like, five or six films. And then they will let them take their chance on whatever their private episode was planned out to be.
Yeah. Now what they're doing, though, is basically, because I've used the example of Josh Trank before, which backfired badly on them. So they try to, like, for the superhero films now, they try to scoop up, like, these guys who make, these young guys that make these, you know, their one-off kind of, like, indie darling quirky hit. And then they try to put them into one of their superhero movies that it backfired horribly with Josh Trank when he tried to make, like, a body horror version of the Fantastic Four, which was a mistake on so many levels, you're actually running into, like, a lot of these problems with these, like, big franchise movies, like the solo Star Wars movie. They had to bring in Ron Howard, yeah, the Happy Days guy. They had to bring him in to finish it because their previous guys had basically turned it into a buddy comedy. Because, like, you give these young guys, like, basically, they make a couple movies, then you put them on their franchise. They're gonna want to bring their version of what, like, they're gonna want to bring their own vision to one of these big blockbuster franchises and not do what the studio system tells them to do.
Have you actually seen the solo film?
No, I don't watch movies.
Oh, dude, man, it's like the Walmart version of mediocrity. It's unbelievably bland.
We should get back to Donnie Darko.
Well, I mean, like, I know that seems like a tangent, but that actually fits, because, like, you go back, like, you see something like that, and then you go back to a movie like Donnie Darko, where, like, you can see, like, this is a guy with, like, he's trying to say something, and sure, he's putting some, like, retardedly adolescent things in this, but it worked. I mean, the movie was a hit, and it was hit with the demographic that it needed to be a hit with, which was, like, young people. Like, Richard Kelly understood that mindset 100%.
Yeah, it's like, I kind of, like, his vision is not bad, but contrasting that versus, like, Matrix trilogy, I actually think there was like way more going on intellectually and philosophically with like that series, and they got away with like a lot more. Like that scene with the architect in the second Matrix film, like I can't think of anything else in modern cinema that approximates like that level of like discourse. Like yeah, it was nuts.
We'll save that though for, because
yeah, we'll do that. It'll be a future.
Well, podcast. That literally is like in, I think if I go in order, the next episode for this is the Dark Knight trilogy, and then after that will be the Matrix trilogy. So that one's upcoming.
Can we do a segue about the so what is your favorite Batman film out of that
trilogy? Okay, we're not doing this, Alex. we're gonna talk about Donnie Darko. Like I allowed a couple tangents, but we got to get back to Donnie Darko. So like, let's kind of like talking about like the movie itself. I've kind of like pondered why it is that Kelly set this in the 80s. Now, like when you pair this with
Caucus,
well, yeah, when you pair this with Southland Tales, and like in Southland Tales, you come to discover that Richard Kelly is a huge Philip K. Dick fan. Like, he does seem to be very focused on these time periods where Republican conservatism seems to reign culturally, much the way that Philip K. Dick was obsessed with Nixon during his time period. But I'm almost wondering as well as like if it's as well as the fact like, you know, in that time period, that late 90s, early aughts time period, because I'm pretty sure this movie was like in production before 9/11 happened. And I know this is like that time period we often refer to where there was really nothing going on. That might be why like there was no, why he ended up setting it back to the 80s, because like you could point to that as a time when there was still some kind of cohesive culture to be rebellious against.
Yeah, and that's what's actually kind of like messed up that film too, was I think the trailers came out a month after 9/11 and they hit an immediate roadblock because there's like an airplane disaster in the film.
Yeah,
like part of the trailer, and that's kind of like what drove the film underground, is you couldn't like really advertise that like on the freaking backdraft from 9/11.
My theory about why it's set in the year 1988 in particular, not in like 89, is because the number 8 looks like an infinity sign turned on its side. And so you have the, you know, it's sort of like isomorphic to the plot where you know, you're going back eternally to fix your previous mistakes. That's my theory anyway.
See, I would normally push back against something like that, but considering that Richard Kelly said about Southland Tales that everything he did in that movie, he did very deliberately, I have to think you're probably right about that, actually, with the 1988 thing. That sounds exactly like something Richard Kelly would be thinking about very deeply of why he chose that year. And then, like, but then you also see it very symbolic with the election and everything, because like with that dinner scene with them talking about politics, that's a microcosm kind of the end of the American family. The daughter not wanting kids until she's 30, wanting to work the whole way through. The brother asking if she'll still be working in the same place. It was, you know, quite like in hindsight, quite on point.
Yeah, there was like a lot of weird stuff like that in that film, like sit next to the cutest boy in class, like that kind of thing. When you think it's the cutest, like. It was definitely
and that's what I mean. Like this, like being like a retarded adolescent film, and it still works. Like it works in spite of that. But like this is like the kind of stuff like you think like, oh man, what if we had like a cool teacher who said like crazy cool things like that? Yeah. Like no, it's like that's like kind of that's the kind of thing like people who are bored in high school like to imagine like the kind of school environment like that. There's something to rebel against, that their teacher like there's that one cool teacher that you know is showing them things they're not supposed to show them. There's like some kind of forbidden knowledge. Forbidden knowledge is a huge aspect of this movie.
Yeah, there's definitely a Dead Poets Society complex going on here with what's her name, the actress who played Gertie,
Drew Barrymore.
Yeah, who played Gertie in E.T., another film from the 80s about a visitor from another world.
Oh, that and that cat. Well, I mean, like they. Because this was started as an indie movie, so it was like a big deal that they got Drew Barrymore. Yeah, that Kelly was definitely had that in the back of his mind when he having like the set in the 80s and having Drew Barrymore in that movie.
Yeah, and like that entire scene with like the predestination situation in Noah Wiley, like, oh, I can't comment further. I'll lose my job.
Yeah. Was the high school was a Christian high school, right?
Well,
it had a cross on the building, didn't it?
I think it might have been a Catholic. Yeah, no, I think it was a Catholic school because like they have the uniforms, and also Roberta Sparrow had been a former nun.
That's right. But it's interesting because you never really see them like teaching any kind of like Catholic dogma in school, even though it is a religious school. Instead, what do they teach? They bring in Patrick Swayze and his like, you know, his emotivist garbage. That's what they teach instead of like, you know, the mysteries of Christ.
Yeah, yeah. Like Patrick Swayze, he's not an explicitly religious character at all. Like what he's teaching is essentially like a materialist like spectrum, like of fear and then love.
Yeah. Well, that's how I mean. I think a lot of the stuff, like, I think a lot of things we're going to be noticing this like have to be like intentional, just because like looking at Kelly's work, like I know for a fact he thinks about this stuff, even though I think he's wrong about a lot of stuff. But I mean, like you have this backdrop of like this is supposed to be like this is he sees this as a very socially conservative society, but they aren't actually teaching religion to these people. And in fact, you have a nun who leaves her order to pursue some kind of, you know, pursue the science and philosophy of time travel. And then you have this religious school that's bringing in some kind of self-help guru that like nothing he says is like rooted in any kind of theology of any sort.
Yeah. Like effectively like imply that God is real and determinism is what like underlies this universe. And essentially like the central character, Jake Gyllenhaal's character, is like a Christ figure. And he talks about like, if you can understand like the future, if you've got precognition, as long as you stay within God's channel, so to speak, like this doesn't like, it doesn't really conflict with like this idea of like determinism at all. Like,
yeah,
like it sort of like hints at some pretty like heavy stuff. It doesn't dig into it very far, but like it hints at it.
It's right on the nose. I mean, like Kelly tells you exactly what he's doing in this movie with some of the visual cues he puts in there. Like he's like, what are the two movies that are showing at that theater?
Right.
he makes it very clear to you what's going on here. So first you have Evil Dead, which I don't know what the exact significance of that is, other than like that's always the movie like you signal for your like cult movie kind of like
did
thing. But
might be evil. We don't know.
Yeah. But The Last Temptation of Christ, the Martin Scorsese film, is the other movie that's playing at that theater. And that's a movie that's about basically Jesus contemplating coming down from the cross and not doing the crucifixion.
Deliberately decide to be the Messiah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, this movie is essentially like an entire, like it was like 2 hours, like a 2 hours of Jesus in the garden contemplating the coming resurrection. The coming crucifixion.
Yeah. It's almost like a coming of age film. It's like your sense of mortality. But the thing I'd mentioned to you, I think, earlier was that like the Matrix, you've got sort of a Christ figure whose path is essentially being dictated to him by a female character, and that their entire connection is also like put into place by another character. Like this happens in the Matrix with Neo and I forget the name of the female character he's hooked up with.
Trinity,
yeah, and Trinity is guided to him by the Blick.
Morpheus.
Not Morpheus.
The Oracle.
The Oracle. The Oracle sets all that in motion, and it's like Frank essentially sets all this in motion with Gyllenhaal's character, and it's kind of like the same thing. Like, if it was not for that particular relationship, none of this would have unfolded the way that it did.
Speaking of bunnies and Christ, I think it's interesting that, you know, you have a Catholic school that doesn't teach doctrine, and sort of in reaction to it, you get this kind of intrusion from the image world of European paganism. And what I mean by that is, you know, of course, rabbits are, you know, they're associated in the primordial mind with you know, procreation, with springtime. And, you know, those images were reappropriated, of course, for Easter time. So you've got this these kind of European pagan images. And it's also crucial that later on in the film, a lot of the action takes place during Halloween.
Yeah, I was about to say, I was about to bring that up once you were down that point. You've got, exactly.
You've got these pagan festivals that were later Christianized, which are sort of flashpoints for paranormal activity that has to do, it's you can read it as a reaction to the life being drained out of, the vital force being drained out of Christian teaching. And these images are drawn from kind of the well of European paganism.
Well, and you also have the very oblique Tolkien reference that's in it. When the teacher, Drew Barrymore, writes on the board, like, as she's leaving, and he asks her, like, what's cellar door? And she says, a famous linguist said that was the most beautiful words in the English language. That was Tolkien who said that. And Tolkien
was not a linguist. He was a philologist.
I know, but that's what she, in the movie, she's, I know that, but in the movie she says, I believe in the movie she says a linguist. I don't believe she said a philologist. Yeah. But yeah. So, I mean, the quote he has here, the quote that comes from is, most English speaking people would admit that cellar door is beautiful, especially if dissociated from its sense and from its spelling, more beautiful than say sky and far more beautiful than beautiful. Well, then Welsh for me, cellar doors are extraordinarily frequent. And then like he goes on to talk about Welsh, but the context of it with Tolkien, I mean, like we have a guy who was a deeply religious Catholic himself, but his writings on like with the Middle Earth that he created is like that. All that stuff was obvious. Like it was his homage to the pagan world of Northwestern Europe that he had fallen very deeply with in his studies. And like that was his kind of way of like, you could see that as a, like, especially with a cellar door, like a door being open, like that's like allowing the gateway into that world. Like, we're talking about like, balancing different worlds in these aspects. And like, the fact that just, again, like, it doesn't seem like a coincidence to me that a Tolkien reference is also placed in this movie, which has a theme of going between worlds and has these pagan Christian elements that are being balanced against them.
Yeah, rabbits are not kosher. That's the other thing.
Yeah, I mean, I guess like kept us off like rewatching that film. I would give it like an 8 of 10. I mean, I feel like, as we discussed previously, like a lot of heavy editing was necessary to make this a decent movie, but just in general, like the soundtrack, the presentation, I mean, there are a few elements that are extremely dated, like the fast forward slow motion effects like around the school, like it's like early 2000s, please, like no more, like God. But the rest of the film, it was fairly solid. There was, and this is like a thing we'll return to later discussing Southland Tales, but there were moments in Donnie Darko that were just like genuinely funny, just like uproariously like funny and spontaneous.
Yeah, no, the elements to me that don't really work as well anymore are the original society posting, like, they made me do this, and of course the aforementioned, like, why are you wearing that stupid human suit thing, like, and like actually some of Gyllenhaal's like performances when he's like show, like supposed to be showing like Donnie's like psychosis and nervous breakdown occurring, like, are kind of like, some it's not that good, especially in that movie theater. But, and also like the other thing that I didn't really care for is like, I don't think a lot of that time travel stuff has aged well, like where they tried to explain it as much. But like, as a movie about some weird stuff happening at Halloween time, like as kind of like an 80s original Stranger Things kind of movie, I think it's fantastic. I still enjoy the movie. My love for it has diminished, but it's still a good movie.
Yeah, like I guess one of the ideas in this film, I mean, you're probably more familiar with this than I am, but like the idea was that jet engine could not coexist in that timeline with like the other jet engine, and that's why it had to be sent back. And then you get the same exact thing kind of happening in Southland Tales. And I don't know. I personally felt that the time travel stuff was not fleshed out very well, and it was not very compelling. And then Frank's character is sort of like, what is going on here? This is extremely incoherent. Like if you think about the logic of the film, like Frank doesn't actually make that much sense.
No, he doesn't.
Yeah, what works for the movie is and this is where like kind of Kelly's strength is kind of like the aesthetic and the way he makes you feel, because like there's my favorite scenes from that are the family scenes, like after the plane turbine crashes into the house and they're in the hotel room, especially that scene between Donnie's parents where they're talking about the kid they knew in high school who died on the way to prom and they were saying he was doomed. Like there's some real pathos in that scene. Boomer Dad is such an awesome character. It's like his reaction when his daughter asks what's a fuck ass. It's like that. It's those little like human family moments that are some of the best parts of this movie, because the family relationships feel very, very real. And it's, I know, in that the sibling relationship between the Gyllenhaals is, you know, like helps part of that, but that part with the kind of like the adolescent teenage drama is like that works as well. But it's also like, again, like the aesthetic kind of aspects of this, like Kelly's really good with music and sound cues. Like another great scene is in that theater. Like I don't care for Gyllenhaal's acting in that scene, but like while they're watching it and then Frank takes off the mask and he turns his head and you see like he's been shot in the face and the way he's speaking and the music that Kelly pairs with that and the sound cues he puts for that, that scene still gives me chills. Like that's a really well done scene.
Yeah. It's very evocative. The entire thing is, I recommend the movie. Like,
yeah.
Wait, Southland Tales on the other hand.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's the problem. And what made Donnie Darko work was that they cut out enough of it that they left just enough to not be explained, but you still generally understood what happened, which is, I think, the makings of a good movie, of any good story, really. It's like where you leave just enough unexplained that you keep people thinking, but you don't want to leave too much where like you don't know what happened. And I don't know. We can get to Southland Tales now, but I want to make sure that Boris has a chance to get his final thoughts out on Donnie Darko, because I kind of steamrolled over that.
Let's see. Well, I wouldn't give this movie, I wouldn't rate this movie that high. I'd say it's like a 6 out of 10. I think it's most interesting. Yeah, it's most interesting because it's a combination of interesting features. But you see all those features in other places. It really doesn't have anything unique to me to offer. But the fact that all of these features coalesce in this movie is interesting to me. So those are my final thoughts.
So speaking of Southland Tales, Frank, can you pull up that the other thing I was told that was going to happen to me after we watched Southland Tales?
I'm going
to
make a drink.
John Lovitz is going to roll up in front of your place in a police car with his frosted hair, and he's going to shoot you in the face. That's what's going to happen.
So, Southland Tales.
Makes me want to watch High School High.
Southland Tales. The donator for this wanted me to get...
I hope he gave you a lot of money.
I know, because I've been wanting to see this movie for a while. I've been curious about it for a while.
My exposure to this movie, I saw this on Netflix. Like, it was up there forever as a film that it was kind of recommended, but I looked at the scores for it and I was like, yeah, I'll pass. I never watched it until we decided to do the show, and then I ended up paying money to see the thing. And wow, just wow. And it's amazing to me too that this was pared down from 250 minutes or whatever to 230.
And you still can't understand it because you have to read the comic books for it to be understood. And the comic books are apparently nothing but exposition. So
well, the film itself is halfway exposition.
It's basically a Philip K. Dick, an attempt to make a Philip K. Dick novel on screen. And the problem is a lot of Philip K. Dick novels do tend to require a lot of exposition to accomplish that. But the way to tackle this, first of all, for the sake of the donator, they originally wanted me to get Sven or Mike on, get their, or Jo, get their reactions to it. And this episode has been the monkey on my back for nearly 2 months now because of scheduling problems and it's just like I think everyone just kind of knows about this movie at this point, that it's a very problematic movie. And I knew that if I tried to make some of those guys watch this movie, they wouldn't even finish it. I doubt they would have even finished it. Like, Sven and Mike and Jo are like the kind of guys to message me and say like, I'm tapping out, dude. Like, I can't take this anymore. Like, after about an hour of it, so I'm going to try again for people who do not understand what we're talking about here. I'm going to read the one synopsis of it that I like to try and get across just how bizarre and incomprehensible and strange this movie is. So let me pull it up for a second here. And of course I went to the wrong location. So let's see here. Okay. I'm pulling this from a Vice article, unfortunately, but I did like this description of it. So, but what exactly is Southland Tales about? Okay, here goes nothing. It's a dystopian sci-fi thriller farce based loosely on the Book of Revelation and set in Los Angeles. A movie star named Boxer Santeros, played by Dwayne Johnson, is tricked into traveling through time alongside a World War III veteran named Roland Taverner, played by Sean William Scott. In the process, both get amnesia, and the space-time rift they created subsequently spawns doubles of each of them, but Boxer's double dies. Boxer begins an affair with an entrepreneurial porn star named Kristen Au, played by Sarah Michelle Gellar, who has written a screenplay that accurately foretells the end of the world. These characters are then attacked, guided, and or manipulated by various larger-than-life figures and organizations. They include a neo-Marxist terror cell with a mostly female leadership, played by Amy Poehler, Sherry O'Terry, and Nora Dunn, amongst others, a mad scientist named Baron von Westphalen, played by Wallace Shawn, who has developed a mystical fuel called Fluid Karma, and a Republican operative, played by Miranda Richardson, in charge of the government's internet surveillance program, USIDENT. Eventually, the Taverner doubles tearfully shake hands in the aforementioned ice cream truck, destroying reality. Oh, and I almost forgot Justin Timberlake. He plays Pilot Abilene, a Bible and Elliot-quoting drug-addled World War III vet and friend of Taverner's who narrates the entire film through an Apocalypse Now-esque voiceover.
So if you don't have a headache yet, I mean, just like sit through the first 20 minutes of this film. Like, just try. Just try. Just give it a shot. Like, no, this movie, and I'm not a Lynch fan. Like, I appreciate what Lynch is trying to do. I get the aesthetic. Like, I understand, like, what Lynch is doing. I don't personally like it. This was like Lynch on a ton of cocaine, and they're like, you can't edit the movie. No, don't edit. Just put this monstrosity out there. This sprawling mess of a fucking film.
Well, at least it'll age well. I mean, no, I'm serious. Like, it's funny, but like, this movie is going to be like a time capsule for what it was like to live in like 2004 through 2006.
That's what I found most interesting about it.
Oh yeah, it's a post 9/11 film for sure. Like, for sure.
If this is what's frustrating to me, because like, there's some stuff in that movie that's actually quite prescient, which like was actually before, like, ahead of its time, but then like it's definitely muddled in a liberal view of what those years were like. When I was in college, I had friends, liberal friends, who like would like earnestly talk about their fears of the Bush administration starting a dictatorship. Like, they really thought that was going to happen. Like, they. So-
Me and Morris were watching this, and one of our observations was like, this dystopia is not really dystopia. Like,
this is the better timeline. It totally is. No, I wish that was the timeline.
it's hard to
so badly that like, that's the better timeline.
Yeah, I'll try. So, okay. How do I even explain like what's going on in this movie? I gave people the plot summary, like, but like, you have United. Okay, so yeah, the United States is
that's actually a pretty good summary. Like, you, it's, that's
I know I, that's the plot summary, but like, so the United, like, I'm the people don't understand, like, if they haven't watched the movie, won't understand like what's going on in the United States. So the United States, like, imagine during the Bush years, like, the neocons basically got everything they want. They basically got everything they want. And that's like the state of the United States at that point. Like, it's, you now, like every state, like, basically every state has like a checkpoint now to get between from state to state. And like, police have been completely dissolved, and now we have like a state police, like a federal police system for the most part now, and you have like Antifa, like actually Antifa is just Antifa, they're the neo-Marxists, but they actually do the work of on behalf of an actual technocrat, which I found hilarious that he's...
My favorite part brilliant. Too is like Wallace Shawn being like, they don't understand Marx. It's basically idiots.
Yeah. And he's actually, he's supposed to be a descendant of Marx because his name, von Westphalen, was the name of Marx's wife, Jenny von Westphalen. So, like, he's supposed to be, like, he's actually, like, this has been, like, confirmed by Kelly, like, he's supposed to be a descendant of Karl Marx, an actual descendant
German
of
Karl Marx. German philosopher, Karl Marx. Yeah.
But so you have that, and then what? Oh, the resource thing. Basically, America's actually going through like a catabolic collapse as well, because like now they're entrenched in warfare all over the world. And I actually laughed at all the countries that were named. It was like,
yeah, no, who was talking about Syria in 2000?
Yeah. Yeah, like that's like the most amazing, because everyone like so because. For context, for people who like either weren't paying attention during that time period or just didn't live through it, and you know, as a cognizant adult, like we had the Axis of Evil, which was North Korea, Iran, and Iraq, which were both represented as places where we were entrenched in warfare, and so I believe Afghanistan was in there as well. But bizarrely, again, movie that came out in 2006, bizarrely, Syria is in there as well as another place we are at war with. That's so like points to Richard Kelly right there for like being prescient on that.
Yeah, he was doing like a Starship Troopers like kind of thing with like that leaderboard.
Yeah, like that opening, like that exposition opening, where basically he's trying to summarize what happened in all the prequel comics and give people the context of what they're going into, which doesn't help at all. No. Is so bizarre, like the aesthetic choices he made. Like there's too much going on. Like he's supposed to, like,
there's supposed to, way too much. It's like, dude,
it's supposed to be like a pip, almost like a pip boy, like kind of like command screen or something. But they have too many things for you to look at the screen that you can't follow what's going on. I needed the subtitles to be able to follow what's going on. I still couldn't follow half of it.
That's how I felt about the entire film. Was like there was just so much happening. It's like okay, like. Just we talked about Videodrome on a previous like pause button. It's like that director took a machete to like his film and edited the crap out of it, and it's essentially what needed to happen here. Like just cut that film in half. And I have not seen the Cannes Film Festival version, which apparently added more characters and more footage to it, and I'm like, it needed less. Like just like,
well, cut the film in half. One of the things that was different in that cut was you know that scene towards the end where the Japanese guy gets his hand cut off, yeah. And we don't understand why that was at all. Like that like makes no sense to us whatsoever. Right. That scene was actually supposed to be closer to the beginning of the film. That was basically him taking out a business rival. It makes more sense. Like it still needed like more explanation, but like it makes more sense in context at the beginning of the film where he's basically like consolidating his power.
I mean, I don't know who's doing editing for this, or like how you would get that monstrosity under control. Is this like the point where you get into like auteur theory and how this like plays into this sort of thing? But
I don't. I mean, like I think even if they like as a collaboration, I think at that point it was too far gone, because like imagine trying. Okay, so imagine you're the editor and Richard Kelly comes in, and is like, okay, they're making me edit down this movie. You need to help me out here. And they're just like, okay. What's your movie about? And you start from there and you realize like I cannot save this movie. This is
you'd be like, all right,
I'm gonna keep the ice cream truck.
I'm gonna pour myself That's the most important thing. Keep Christopher Lambert. I'm gonna pour myself a drink. I will be back to you in a second and we'll discuss this. But yeah, like I think George Lucas had kind of come up like having studio control really helped a lot of his films. Cause
well, the first Star Wars movie was a notorious disaster that was like saved in editing. And a lot of the changes that were made, Lucas had been against. And like, you look at some of like the early ideas that were for Star Wars, like of having like, I think like C-3PO was like a used car salesman type character or something. Like, you know, like go look at some of like one of the early, some of the early ideas for what Star Wars was. they were off the wall, you know, just absolutely bonkers. Like they were trying, I mean, like the Jabba, like the reason why like the Greedo scene, for instance, was created was because they couldn't get Jabba to work. And then like when they tried to actually like, you know, with computer make the Jabba scene later, like you realize like why that's such a much weaker scene. Like the idea of like Han being in trouble with gangsters is much better. Communicated in that Greedo scene. That's like, this is why I kind of reject a lot of ideas like of the director of being auteur, because like collaboration for me is extremely important, because I'm a writer myself. I've been involved in various collaborative projects, and I always find that I see a much better product or project that's being created when there's other sets of eyes that have different perspectives than me on it. Like I know there are some directors that might have a truly singular vision, but there are times where that vision needs to be challenged, and especially for young men. And Richard Kelly, as a young man, should not have been allowed to make whatever he wants.
Yeah, like that film, Southland Tales, has a lot of really like good stuff in it. It does, but just so much like crap surrounding this. Like it needed to be hit with machete, like good and hard. Like
he's very good at the micro, like the sets, the costumes, the individual lines of dialogue, the graphics, the casting, like all that stuff is pretty good. But anything more complicated than a character or a scene, he has tremendous problems with.
He shoots a fucking music video in the middle of it for that.
Okay, that threw me off. And like Morris is like, that's good.
That's
like
the highlight of the movie for me.
Yeah, like, no.
By itself, sure. By itself, that's great. But like, it's like plopped down in the middle of this feature. And I'm like, what is happening? Why?
Yeah, no, he's basically, I think it's like basically he's, I read the explanation for it. Is like he's basically transmitting ideas into one of the other characters' mind. I think he's transmitting ideas into Tavener's mind, I believe was the, like, this is the way he's transmitting these ideas over there, is through this kind of like trippy song, because like there's like a lot of like drug effects going on at the same time and the like. But I mean, the point of bringing that up is like that music video, which is, that's all it is. It's a music video. He shot an actual music video right in the middle of his movie, an actual like beginning to end with an actual arc music video. This uploaded by itself on YouTube, it's got like over 1 million views. Like it's more than like the people who saw this movie. Like that's like, and that's like his talent. Like he's such a great aesthetic director. Like, and the thing that occurred to me like is like this is again Richard Kelly probably being way before his time, because if he had just sat on these ideas and waited, maybe had done a couple more movies and built up his profile, like this would have been like probably a fantastic kind of like out there like TV series. Like,
yeah,
this would have been perfect for a TV series.
He was ahead of his time. Like, understand, like John Lovitz like makes the best psychopathic cop ever.
Oh my god, that scene, like the John Lovitz scene is fantastic.
Yeah, the other highlight was Amy Poehler getting shot.
Yeah, it, like so much of this humor too. Like you could not help but laugh. Like the scene on the beach where oh god,
the character says, "I want to suck your dick."
Yes. Oh, yeah. Oh my god! Like
it was reliably funny. Like about every 5 minutes, you would laugh your ass off. And then you would have to slog through another 5 minutes of just like, what the fuck?
The reason why like a lot of the comedy and the stunt casting was done for this was because Kelly was worried he was making way too much of like a very dour movie, because like this is a movie that's about the apocalypse and the end of the world. And I think he also kind of wanted to highlight the whole aspect of basically, you know, when the world's ending, like just have a big party. Like, I think he wants to kind of like focus on like the absurdity of the end of it all, but like he overloaded it way too much, and since you don't really understand what's going on in the plot, it turns into this very bizarre kind of farcical comedy. Like in the, like the little moments are some of the best stuff. Like you have like Dwayne the Rock's like his little like nervous tick motions that he does whenever he's like scared and like with his eyes darting around. That's great. Like, or like the scene when they're finally explaining everything that happened, that they basically found a rift in time, and what do? They threw monkeys through it.
Oh yeah, that was Booger. That was Booger from Revenge of the Nerds.
The thing that was like blowing my mind too, like I spotted like Will Sasso early on. I was like, wait a minute. It's like half the Mad TV cast and the other half is like SNL.
Yeah. Yeah. What? Sherry O'Terry.
Yeah. In it. Everybody in Hollywood who unironically liked Donnie Darko. Yeah.
Well, it's Kevin Smith who was like, who's Richard Kelly's like biggest back. Like he's like, there's nobody who wants Richard Kelly to make another movie more than Kevin Smith does. Like
Kevin Smith as Alexander Dugan.
Yeah, like, Kevin Smith plays Alexander Dugan in this movie. Because we're making this movie sound way more interesting than it is, and maybe it's more enjoyable. Like, to be honest, like I watched it, like I had it on in the background the second time through, and it was less like before this episode, and it was less of a slog this time because like after I kind of like reacquainted myself with what the plot was and what was happening, I was able to kind of like focus more and more on the little moments. And the problem is like if you go into this blind, like, your brain is trying to figure out what the fuck is going on right now.
Yeah, I think you need three viewings at least to like really get it. Like, this is like a film. If you're like getting smashed at your house, just put this on the background. Just like do this a few times a week.
Yeah, like catch it in the little moments, basically.
Yeah,
I want to go on Facebook and find out whose favorite movie this is because it has to be somebody's favorite movie. Well, to find out,
dude, this movie has a cult following, just like Donnie Darko did. And it's not as strong as Donnie Darko's cult following was, but like this movie is a polarizing, extremely polarizing movie, and it has extremely ardent defenders. And I actually understand why.
It's I really do for, like the wrong reasons though. Like, okay, it does have some moments of genius in there, but like it needed work.
Do you remember that Superfan documentary about Donnie Darko I was telling you about, where like you have this super autistic guy who's obsessed with, like that's who Richard Kelly's like super fan base is. Like he appeals to these people who like get really into the weird supernatural minutia of science fiction, basically. Like it's a very extremely niche audience. It's like it doesn't help that this movie is basically like a Philip K. Dick pastiche, and he's very on the like. That's one of like Kelly's things, is like he's very on the nose with his references. Like, you know, you have The Last Temptation of Christ in Donnie Darko. In this one, like you literally have a policeman after he shoots somebody in the face, a policeman played by John Lovitz, say, "Flow my tears." And if you don't get that reference, there is a Philip K. Dick novel called "Flow My Tears." The policeman said. And then like the quote unquote twins are really they're just the same person, the Taverners. That's the name of the protagonist from Flow My Tears, the policeman said. And he's got a bunch of other references to some of other Philip K. Dick's books, or the plots kind of follow similar points. I had them written down. Yeah. Okay, yeah, you got Starla von Luft, who believes she's in a movie, shares her surname with an android actress in Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep. You have psychic drugs allowing a shared consciousness, which was a central plot element of The Three Stigmata of Palmer Eldritch. You have Club Jenny with its these are the Andy Warhol references. But like you also have like if the latter part of Philip K. Dick's career, he turned very like he became very religious, but he became literally a Gnostic Christian, basically. And he thought he was like living out. He believed he was still like he was basically the Roman, like the meme of the Roman Empire never ended. Like that comes from Philip K. Dick, the Black Iron Prison, that kind of stuff. Like basically he believed he was like living through like a Gnostic simulation kind of thing. And so he wrote his last novels were Valis, The Divine Invasion, and the Transfiguration of Timothy Archer, and they all have extremely deep religious themes to them. And because this is a movie that's also about the Book of Revelation, like he's kind of doing, like, and these characters are embodying like these different archetypes of the Book of Revelation, these different figures that are supposed to be prophesized to come. He's kind of like doing a Philip K. Dick mixing religious and science fiction thing with it as well.
Although I don't think he really understands what he's doing in terms of just sort of picking and choosing these religious elements.
Well, that's what I mean. Like, this is what I mean about like when that comment earlier about kind of Richard Kelly being a bit of a retarded adolescent, and why he understood later like why you shouldn't make a movie before you're 30, because he was that guy. He was that guy who was into like I'm that guy that's all into like all this weird literature, and you probably don't read this stuff. And he wanted to jam like, and you get like so obsessed with the stuff, but you're what you're interested in is so distinct from one another, and like you want to jam as much of it as possible. I've done this before as a writer. Like, I've tried to jam too many things, too many ideas into it because I want to like make references to this and that and in every other which way. Like, you have to like, no, like you need to focus, and you need to not like make everything so referential. I mean, like, that's how we end up in these media saturated cultures to begin with, where everything becomes very referential.
Everything becomes Robot Chicken.
Yeah.
Kelly doesn't really understand, like, he wants to include the Christian idea or ethic of self-sacrifice, but he doesn't really know how it works. Like, he doesn't understand that, like, it's a grammar of, like, interlocking images.
Yeah.
And, well, like, this is... he just takes the images. Oh yeah, I'll just shove all these images in my movie and it'll work because that's deep. Like, I'll just have my characters kind of like, you know, scream that they want to suck each other's dick.
Well,
religious imagery.
Well, I think that's kind of like the self-limiting mental aspect sometimes of like liberalism when it comes to, you know, it comes to art and religion and the like, is that they often don't have the mental constitution to understand that because they're not able to put themselves into that aspect. Like, they're not able to, it's why signaling is such a huge part of it. Cause like, that's kind of the only way sometimes they're able to feel like, that's one of the most frustrating things about this movie is like, there's interesting ideas in this and there are ideas I even agree with, but you can tell like it's coming from like a liberal mind that's terrified that, you know, that the Bush administration is going to like institute a draft. Like, that's like where this is coming from.
We were talking about like the idea of the Patriot Act, like in that time period, that was a big fear. It was like the repercussions of the Patriot Act. And like in retrospect, that seems like nothing now. Like, we are so far past that. I also thought it was kind of interesting. Like, people have contrasted this director to Christopher Nolan and have implied that if there is like more studio control, he could have maybe been a Christopher Nolan type. And maybe done more interesting stuff than Nolan. I don't know. Like,
he needed
not difficult, by the way.
he needed a mentor, is what he needed. He had, yeah. Like, especially after Donnie Darko, he had so many people telling him like how awesome he is and how brilliant he was and that he was an auteur. He didn't have an actual mentor.
X-Men 2, right?
What?
Like, they offered him X-Men 2, like to direct the sequel to the original X-Men. He like turned it down.
Probably would have been a much better movie.
Right.
That would have been a very fascinating movie. But like, you can like,
they're visited by an actual Wolverine, somebody actually dressed in a Wolverine suit.
I mean, this movie killed his career, and the tragedy of it all is like he had a couple of other projects he was trying to get off the ground. One of them, like, he was working on something with James Gandolfini, and then Gandolfini died.
Yeah, he died.
And that was the end of that. It was like after The Box, which was his last feature film that he did, every subsequent project has fallen through. He hasn't made a movie in 10 years. And this movie deeply wounded him. He's still obsessed with it. He still wants to do something with this movie. He talks about how much this movie still haunts him. And I often wonder if it's because like of the colossal failure it was. He's not able to get past it now. Like, this is his, like, this has become his white whale.
Yeah, I mean, it's like he had a rookie win and then immediately went down the toilet, and after that there was like no recovery. Like, if maybe he had a few decent like films past that and then released this, it would have been different, but
you think he hangs out with the guy who made Boondock Saints? Just like drinking together.
Yeah, I'm just digging through my notes right now. I mean, like, cause like some of the, like, again, like some of the ideas
really well comparison too. Cause like the original Boondock Saints was sort of like a freaking spark in the dark or whatever. And then after that, you got the sequel and it was, wow. Ooh.
Autism time.
One of my favorite scenes, like especially on the rewatch, was when they're trying, like, which leads into that John Lovitz scene, which is when they have Boxer with Taverner and they're going on that ride, and they're trying to get they're trying to recreate this space. Okay, so this is like, these are the neo Marxists. This is Antifa. So you have Antifa trying to
neo Marxists.
trying to like they're trying to create what they believe a racist and fascist cop is supposed to act like, and they get really excited. They get really excited when he says the N-word. It makes it sound believable.
Yeah.
And like they begin like kind of like critiquing like his performance and all that, and trying to like because like they're trying to simulate this as much as possible. Like that's like and that's the kind of like the in this movie like the stuff that works. And if you watch like them in like in little scenes, like if you watch this movie a little bit piece by piece instead of trying to watch it all in one sitting and make sense of it,
yeah,
that's you, like the stuff about this that works because like there's it this like I know we've said this before, but like this movie was ahead of its time in many ways, like the, especially like with the. Like this is a movie about media and its effect on people, in addition to all the other things that it's about. Because like you have a character who, the one that's you know yells at him, "I want to suck your dick." God, there's gonna be so many drops from this. She gets pulled into this, which this is a very Dickian thing as well. She gets pulled into this by the fact that she read the script that's going to accurately predict the future online, and she's like now she believes that she's one of the characters, which is like this is like a big aspect as well of postmodern, because this is a very postmodern movie. Like this is a very big aspect like of kind of postmodern literature of like the of the hyper reality where people will believe that they are becoming the characters if not the character being the characters themselves.
It's like part of Stan Twitter.
Yeah, basically. I mean, this is like she's an early part of Stan Twitter for the most part. It's just like she can speak English is the main difference.
Quixote complex. That's what's going on.
The what? Oh, Quixote. Yeah, exactly. Like, it's actually, and that's always like kind of like the very the most fascinating thing about like the first Western novel is a novel about the effects of stories on people. Like the very first Western novel is basically a postmodern novel where it's about a person who has delved so deeply into fiction they can no longer discern what's real and what isn't, and tried to emulate things they've read in stories. And because like at the time that Cervantes wrote that, like they, like everyone knew like these like knightly stories were bullshit. Like this is not how knights were. Like, I mean, you know,
different things. Like,
yeah,
they were indicating different things.
Like, yeah,
nobody believed them literally.
Yeah.
But it gets even better because, Don Quixote was published in two parts. And in the first part, you know, he has all these weird adventures where he believes that, you know, windmills are giants. But in the second part, everybody else in the story has read part one, except for Don Quixote and Sancho. So everybody else is in on the joke and knows about Don Quixote's condition.
Yeah.
So it's even more postmodern, even though it's from like the 1600s.
Well, a lot of that's the consequence of the fact that there's no technology at that time, like in the media technology to be precise. There's no media technology at that time. So this was like when you look at early drama and the way that theater developed, because like there's no fourth wall in that, like
McLaurin.
in the Greek, you know, in the Greek tragedies, the chorus is speaking directly to the audience. Like the audience is acknowledged. Like if you read those works, they are speaking directly to them. And this goes on through theater as well, up through, you know, even to Elizabethan Shakespearean theater, like with the soliloquies. This becomes a lot more clear when you hear it in original pronunciation, when you kind of hear it like, in the way it would have been spoken to the people who were hearing this. But like you have the actors are like in a lot of their soliloquies are kind of like rhetorically asking the audience, what should I do? What am I to do in this moment? So because like, you can't like, because it's very obvious when you're looking at a person or you're reading a story, like I'm reading or looking at something that isn't real. This is just a story that the fourth wall is always a lot more nebulous, but when media technology is able to actually establish more of a fourth wall, it actually becomes less postmodern over time, ironically, as it moves towards modernism, because like the technology aspect starts to blur what reality is for you and what isn't, because it's able to more simulate a reality to you.
So,
which I think, I mean, like that's kind of off topic, but I also don't think it really is, because like Southland Tales, like that, the most real parts of this movie to me is like the way that the neo-Marxist act out. They remind me so much of like how much of how goofy Antifa can be, like especially like when they got like they were disappointed that Klansmen didn't show up in their actual robes.
Yeah, well, that's like Wallace Shawn, like basically making fun of them for not understanding like any kind of actual like Marxist ideology. Like,
yeah,
them basically just like being fake, like
while being a technocrat himself who's using them to his own ends.
Yeah,
is way too real for me.
Yeah, it's extremely real. I don't know what kind of like Morris has like a string of notes here, which dude, I tried taking notes on this movie and I gave up immediately. I was just like, all right.
I have a note on here. I made fun of some of like, the really like just like again like making fun of Kelly and the way he just puts it in your face of what he's trying to say. It's like, oh, I get it. Senator Bobby Frost is Robert Frost, and he quotes Robert Frost, and it's the like fire and ice is about the end of the world. Oh, I get it. I guess that's kind of clever. Oh, and there's a guy named Elliot, like T.S. Eliot. Oh, okay, yeah, I get that too. Oh, Proposition 69. Do you get it? It's like if we did a movie and did Proposition 1488.
Yeah.
Oh boy.
It's like setting down Darko in 1988. I mean,
you want to get some of your notes, Morris?
I just had one final comment on, I guess, the lack of solutions that Kelly proposes for any of these problems. It's like,
liberals don't have any solutions. Basically, I mean,
neocons are running amok, and young masculinity is in crisis. So what do we do, Richard? Well, have you tried going back in time and killing your shadow self?
You ever read Jung? You ever listen to Tool? You listen to 46 and 2?
I know the pieces fit.
Yeah.
The other way that he was, I know he was it's funny, like, because he's commenting on the Britney Spears and Christina Aguilera stuff of the time period where, like, you have these people who start out, like, in Mickey Mouse Club, and they're growing up to be these very sexualized pop stars. But, like, some of the, like, the funniest stuff that just, like, has, like, is truer now than even then. It's like, you have, what's that song she has, like, teen horniness is not a crime. And she
never said it was.
and the porn stars got
dad from Donnie Darko.
Yeah. And the porn stars got like her whole like spiel about like Puritans mess sex up, and before they were Puritans, like everyone was having like Indian sex orgies and the
basically
like.
Basically predicted roasty Twitter.
Yeah.
That she was so funny. Like her saying that, I was like, wow, you could not ever get away with that. Like, to film these days, like that, like ironic line. Like, that was a whole other level.
Okay, I do have a what did he mean by this question for you guys, because like I completely passed over this, and I can't, like, I have to mention it, otherwise I'm going to be crucified by the comments who have actually seen this. So, you know, Boxer has a giant star of David tattooed on his navel. Then he gets in bed with a white woman. What did Richard Kelly mean by this?
Well, did you also see there's like a brief moment like where they have like that line revelation about the synagogue of Satan and the Jews, like that pops up like on screen?
Those who say they are Jews but are not.
Wait a minute. He gets in bed with Sarah Michelle Gellar. Is she Jewish or is she? Never mind. She doesn't get in bed with a white woman. Never mind. I guess I should have known, like, she's a porn star. What? Of course.
Yeah, I mean, like honestly, like the Star of David thing, it was like immediate, and I kind of forgot about it because it's like just so obvious and so funny.
I wonder how many of those are his real tattoos.
None of them, except for the Star of David.
I would not put it past him.
And then I saw some reviews too, where they're like, "Wow, what's with the acting in this film?" And it's like. It's like, dude, okay, brah, he's doing like the David Lynch thing where it's like intentionally like stilted. Like, come on. Like, there is like a particular scene where like you can see like an actress is like intentionally like trying to personally, like she's trying to hesitate like on purpose. Like, and it's so obvious.
Yeah. It's like, it's kind of like his attempt to kind of like, you know, formulate like a hyper real simulation of how insane the aughts seem to be to people like him, to liberals. And
well, so apparently there's an explanation for this, like bedded in the full narrative, like due to the slowing rotation of the Earth, people act retarded. That's why the dialogue looks retarded and people act retarded. Apparently, you need to read the prequel comics to fully understand this.
Any time where somebody says, bro, just like anytime a movie has like a voiceover and somebody who really likes it says, if you have to read this other thing and it'll make sense, right. That's like you've already run into problems here.
Yes.
Like the voiceovers are bad enough as it is. Like you, like when you have to extensively rely upon a voiceover in a movie, you done goofed. What?
Like Justin Timberlake with a battle scar, like that kind of voiceover, like disinterested Justin Timberlake, battle scar over half his face, describing things.
He apparently has like very little memories of doing this movie, so he was probably high as a kite.
What it was about, and yeah. I don't know what this movie is about. So I mean, me and him are like buddies now, I guess. Like I don't know either.
I'm going to guess he was also probably high as a kite while he was doing this. Like, all right. You need
to be high if you're watching the film. Like, I don't want to like suggest to people to engage in degenerate activities, but realistically, how can you watch this sober?
I mean, we didn't. No, I mean, I win alcohol, but
I wanted more. I was like, I need a lot of drugs. Like obviously, the film was designed by people on drugs for people that are also on drugs. Like,
oh, I completely bypassed this note when we were talking about like the porn stars when they're like the stuff they're complaining. Like, you have the porn stars complaining about the nerds. Like, it's the way that that you know you got roasty Twitter complaining about incels now.
Fucked up sex for everyone in America, like.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, like, the shit that they say in this movie is the same shit they were saying about Kavanaugh.
Yeah, I mean, there's lines in the film like you just can't help but like just bust out laughing. Like so much of the film like just catches you off guard. Like John Lovitz, like being like this psychopathic, like vicious police officer who like kills people in cold blood, and then like I guess did he fuck Sherry O'Terry or something like that? Like.
Yeah.
You ever see him again? What happened to him? I forget. Did he die? What happened to
him? No, John Lovitz. Oh, no, the character? Or John Lovitz?
Yeah. Did he just disappear? Like, we just don't see him anymore?
Oh, he dies in the apocalypse, because, like...
Oh, yeah, well, yeah.
But, yeah, I don't believe he dies, like, in the con. I don't think he dies.
I don't think you can kill him.
He's like a cockroach.
He's like the physical embodiment of, like evisceration destruction. Like, you can't kill that guy.
He's the critic. I mean, he's the critic.
That's it. That is my, like, I know I've already said this, but that is my favorite scene where he comes in and just shoots them. It's while they're, cause like in that argument they're having is hilarious. Like
no, it's, wow. Like
yeah, whoever that black actor is just cannot hold his own against, Amy Poehler. In improv, which that was obviously an improv scene. Yeah.
Well, that this is like what was like this movie like was messing with me a lot because you know these people are playing very exaggerated caricatures, but like with the like that slam poetry stuff. It's like I knew these people, I knew these types of people, and it was like this is the problem of talking about this movie because. You spend too much time trying to explain what exactly happened to it because it's too plot heavy. When like if this was a movie about like a time period instead of trying to resolve this towards like an apocalypse, like if this was about like an America that had just completely lost its mind, it was more like vignettes about that. This would have worked a lot better, like as a series of set pieces or something like that, because. When it's so plot heavy like this and so convoluted to impenetrable, like, because like there's a lot to say like with sex and technology and reality and perception, all that with that.
Yeah, but
like there's not enough for you to draw any like ideas off of other than like just go listen to anything else I've said about it. Like Kelly does not give us much to work with here.
Yeah, like that scene with the CGI in the jeeps that were having sex with each other. I mean, Why?
Like, why? And then like he has to ruin that as well, like with where he has the character like pointed out. Like he does this a lot of like pointing out what just happened. And like Lydia, you know, like that's a reference. We're doing like here's what here like trying to tell you this is what I'm doing in this scene. That's like ultimately where my frustrations with this came, because like I like I said, I watched it a second time and I actually enjoyed it a bit more on my second viewing, and I like it has stuff I love. Like I love Philip K. Dick stuff. I love like the illusion set. I like some of the set pieces about it, but it fails ultimately as a single piece, and it just does not work in the least bit.
I don't think I could subject myself to a second viewing, and there were parts of this film that were like seriously, like even the Lynchian stuff, like the oh god, what's the scene where the main character is talking about something or other. It's like, well, thank you very much. He's like, yes. Like he just like interjects like yes, like
this, yes,
like, just like throws this in there like out of nowhere.
I acknowledge.
Yeah. Like where you would never give an affirmation. Like this guy just like tosses that line in, and it was like, and this happened constantly in the film. It was like it catches you off guard and you laugh hard for a second or two. And I'm not even a Lynch fan, and like this is like a Lynchian kind of thing, like the awkward, like stilted dialogue on purpose, like
yeah, you keep the first take. The first take is the one that you makes it into the movie.
And there's one thing we haven't really talked about, because there's not like, because it illustrates why Donnie Darko worked, and this one among many reasons doesn't, is there's a time travel aspect to this movie, and it here's the problem with time travel and why you need to stop doing it, basically. Every aspect that has been thought about when it comes to time travel has already been covered. So if you try to make something new, you're going to do some kind of weird, bizarre stuff like what Richard Kelly did, and it's going to require tons of exposition to try and explain it to people so that, you know, like you can claim to have like, oh, well, here's my unique take on time travel. Okay. Just don't do it.
Is for you, Borzoi, to go back in time and prevent people from making bad time travel movies.
That would be the most meta thing of all. I gotta make it happen now. It will make me gay, I guess.
You go back in time and then the thing comes out of your chest and you see where you have to go.
Yeah. But
see, that's predestination. And so as long as you stay in the Borzoi channel, as we would say, and you don't deviate from that, like the timeline remains intact and just makes the entire point of this useless, really.
I basically have to go back in time and become Borzoi Jesus. Past
again. Yeah. You were destined to go back in time.
Time and do the same thing over again.
Basically, in order to stop all time travel movies from being made, I have to be hit by a plane somewhere back in time.
That was like the most annoying thing about Donnie Darko, is like, okay, tangent universe, but it's not like a multiverse thing. It was just BS, basically. Like, and then everybody wakes up from tangent universe and they have like memories of it. Like, what?
I think actually what I have to do is I have to go hijack the Wright Brothers plane and crash it into a movie studio. I think crash it
into Richard Kelly just.
You crash it into like Charlie Chaplin.
But the other reason why people need to stop doing time travel movies is because if you're going to do time travel, like you have to basically more focus on like just the story itself or the human aspects of it, whatever story you're trying to tell, and not get bogged down in the minutia of trying to explain time travel. Cause that's like, that's what Kelly tries to do in his director's cut of Donnie Darko. And it's some of the stuff he's doing is like, don't do that.
Yeah. The basic issue with like time travel is it like removes narrative tension. Cause like anything could be reset and put back to the way it used to be. Like that's the major issue with any kind of time travel plot. And that's why, I don't know, you should just avoid that unless it's Star Trek. And Star Trek beat that horse to death, like over 20 years. Like they destroyed that horse. They beat it to death, went back in time, resurrected it, and killed it again. Like, oh my God.
There's some time travel movie with Bruce Willis and...
We watched that, didn't we?
We did.
What's it called? It's Looper. I believe it's Looper.
He directed, was it the last Star Wars movie?
Yeah. Oh, it's Rian Johnson. Yeah, that's right. It's Rian Johnson. Yeah. Yeah, where like they have a scene in it where basically he tells his past self, don't think too hard about this.
That's like the biggest cop out, and I've seen this in multiple films lately. Is them doing that, like, oh, we're just don't think about the time travel too hard. Like, okay, just don't put it in your movie then. How about that?
There's the balance. Finding the balance is basically ultimately the difficult thing to do, and that might be why you want to pay for a good editor to like figure out what the balance of that is.
Yeah, I mean, you can do a time travel film, but it's hard, and it, like I said, like it removes tension due to the fact you can just reset stuff. Like, it introduces the idea that nothing that happens in the film really matters because it'll be put back to zero before the film ends, and that's a huge problem.
Yeah, I guess the only other thing I really have to say, because you were mentioning kind of like the weird reactions and the weird acting in this, because I did actually have a note on this. There's something to be said about Kelly wanting to tell a story about the manufactured realities of Hollywood and how that seeps into the lives of people in LA, because like that's the Southland. With Baudrillard, we need to treat the world as post-apocalyptic, and Kelly attempts that here with the unreality of the film. The one Antifa guy does his attempt to be a racist cop. This is all performance. Antifa wants their fake cop to be a more realistic racist cop.
Yep. Yeah, no, I like that aspect. I guess my problem is, like, and like I said multiple times, I'm not a Lynch fan, but like Lynch does this so much better. Like, the intentionally, like, stilted acting and dialogue, like, making stuff look awkward, like, making you aware of, like, the unreality. Like, it's so much more on point with Lynch. And with Kelly,
he's had more practice.
Yeah. one of the greatest scenes where he blurred that distinction was in Twin Peaks, where you have in the original Twin Peaks, where you have like the jazz music that's playing in the background, and you know, like your brain is trained to treat it as like that's that characters don't hear the music that's setting the mood. And then at the end of the episode, as that music's going, then I forget the character, the FBI guy starts snapping along with the music.
I'm not a Lynch fan, but like I do appreciate his work. Like, I understand like his creative like energy and all that.
Mulholland Drive might be ultimately a better movie about LA culture more.
Yeah, for sure.
And more, much more so than.
I'm going to get him to watch. What is it? Blue Velvet. He still hasn't seen Blue Velvet.
Are you talking about McNabb?
Yeah, McNabb hasn't seen Blue Velvet. Just, I mean, it enjoyed mainstream success, from what I understand. Like,
well,
it's not really out there as much as.
I don't think you can do that kind of stuff anymore. Like, when you had a much more cohesive culture. When you have a much more cohesive culture, they're actually more willing to like entertain. When it's not like a multi-million dollar industry, they're more willing to try different things out.
You can't do that when you're trying like markets like China. Like,
yeah,
everything has to like hit this global market. Like, you just cannot put out that kind of stuff. Like, I don't know. We didn't get to like the auteur like kind of thing that far, but you know, you can't deal with like that sort of like hyper-specific certain flavors of direction. You know, you just can't.
Yeah. All right. I think you guys kind of... do you guys have any final thoughts on this?
I
notebook here.
He's going to check his notebook. I would say you should watch this. You should probably be intoxicated. Maybe on multiple substances. I don't know. Don't try to take notes. I try to take notes and then immediately gave up. just like put this on and just absorb it. Just absorb it and just laugh at the funny fucking shit that happens. Because like, a lot of the dialogue is genuinely like the most hilarious stuff. Like the humor in this is really, really great.
I would recommend, if you do that, just read a plot synopsis first. Do not go into this movie blind. Like, try to like get a general understanding and just not understand. Like, this is a movie. It's basically a like what if the Book of Revelations played out, but with all these people from a mid, from a mid-aughts, psycho America from Hollywood kind of thing, and enjoy that aspect of it. In terms of recommendation, if you like the works of Philip K. Dick, I think you definitely need to check this out. If you like the idea, like if you like some like the postmodern idea stuff that I'm really into, I would definitely check this out. I wouldn't give it that high, to be honest. It's a fascinating document to me. If you are fascinated by just bizarre messes, I would recommend checking out. But if you're looking for like a cohesive, fun movie that's bizarre but also fun to watch, probably want to pass on this. Then like this is more interesting for what a failure of ideas it was than it was as like an actual enjoyable vehicle.
So I have some final thoughts.
Go for
Donnie Darko, actually.
Okay. We can round back to that.
So I think that this movie is sort of guilty of romanticizing self-destruction to a certain extent.
I would say that it also extends to Southland Tales as well.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that one of the best scenes in Donnie Darko is, of course, the scene where he's respond. It's the Q&A session with the inspirational speaker. And Donnie gets up there on the stage and he pulls the microphone up to his level, and he basically just gives better advice than Patrick Swayze. And the advice he gives is basically to invest in yourself, and that's, there are lots of people listening to this now. If you're a young guy and like you consume a lot of culture that romanticizes self-destruction, just like step back and think about it. That's what I wish somebody had told me when I was a young man. So I don't know. Wholesome posting.
Wash
your penis.
Yes. Yes, definitely. Do you recommend Southland Tales at all?
Yeah, if you like weird shit, sure.
I mean, I get a 10 because I unfortunately have watched recent films, and I mean, wow, just wow. By comparison, like Southland Tales it does have good moments. It's got some good comedy in there. It's weird and interesting enough that I think people should watch it.
Yeah, it's one of the most fascinating messes of a movie.
Don't be too invested in, like, understand you're going to watch something that if you try to get invested in it, you're probably going to be disappointed. Like,
yeah, it's got great aesthetic detail, though, especially Kelly's great when he matches music with scenes. Like, he makes some great choices in this. I thought the version of Wave of Mutilation that he used I don't know what it is about Kelly's aesthetic style when he does his movies, but like, he's really good with these little moments, and little moments is what like kind of save Southland Tales from being like a complete unmitigated disaster. It's just like hard to get to those moments sometimes, especially like when your brain is trying to make sense of like what you're seeing on the screen. It's a overly stimulated movie. Like there's way too much stimulation on the screen. And that's like one of the, I think that really works against it.
That's what hurts this film. Like if it had just been pared down and edited severely, like if this was like chopped into like a 90 minute film, and if they eliminated like essentially like half the characters and like tightened up the plot, the script, it probably would have been extremely good. Like it would have been like a popular film at the very least.
And I do actually recommend it, like just for people. One aspect I do recommend people watch it for is like to get a sense of like how insane the aughts were, because obviously what we're living through now puts that to shame, but I mean, people always talk about nostalgia for the 80s and nostalgia for the 90s and like how simpler things seemed to be at that time.
9/11 film, for sure.
Yeah. This is a movie about where like our first inkling that we were no longer living in a safe world, and we were living in a world that was like teetering towards the brink of collapse. Because like basically the apocalypse looms large in Kelly's films. It's like the Donnie Darko is about that. Southland Tales is about that. And he has that kind of, I think he's technically an Xer, I believe. He's either like an Xer or a Xennial, something like that. But he's got that mindset like that the good days are already over and we're already living in the apocalypse kind of thing, that Baudrillardian kind of mindset about it. And you get like all that, like all those real inklings like that of it no longer being avoidable, like was really coming out in the aughts. Now you had to deal with like literal hysteria. Like that's the funniest thing about it. It's like that was, even though like because they lost two presidential elections and a couple of congressional elections, liberals were losing their minds and thinking it was all over and that there was going to be a dictatorship that put them all into Republican death camps. So it's a fascinating document from that time period when they genuinely thought this kind of stuff. But I mean, like you see everything that prefigured everything that we're in now, and you see all the seeds of everything we're in now in this kind of stuff.
Yeah. That's like the Daily Show period. So you were talking about, you're going to, I guess, get into the Christopher Nolan, like Batman trilogy and the Matrix. Is that like what's on deck?
Yeah. I'll just quickly read off the, what's coming up on the pause button. Let me just pull them up here. I don't. 1 second. I know it's the Dark Knight trilogy and the Matrix trilogy, which I'll move them out of order just in case, like just for scheduling issues. But they are technically what's next. I have both of the Blade Runner movies. I have Shilim Do, which is a Korean movie about a South Korean unit that tried to assassinate Kim Il-sung, which I'm excited to do that one. And I got Rubber, that movie about the sentient tire.
I've seen that. Yes, that's
Rubber. Yeah, Rubber's a trip.
Yeah, I would honestly like Rubber. I would maybe recommend that over what we saw last night.
Yeah, Rubber made way more sense.
Yeah. God. Yeah. No. So like the Nolan films, I'm kind of interested in, especially like the Matrix films. I'm really interested in discussing those. I had watched those about 2 months ago again and had a new appreciation, especially for like the second film, which is the one that everybody hates. Like,
yeah, I hate it.
Yeah, like I loved it the second time around. Like, I'm sitting there like enraptured by like listening to the architect's dialogue, and I'm like, yeah, I get it. Like, it's great. Like, this is fucking great. And I remember thinking to myself, like, how did this get made? How did he get this on screen? Like, this is good stuff. He's talking about determinism. It's amazing. He's talking about, like, Neo being, like, a false rebel. It's great.
Yeah. Well, I don't think we have anything else to say about these movies. They are...
Nah, I think we're good. Just watch Rubber. Just go watch
check them all out. Go for a very trippy evening. But with that, I'm going to push the pause button on this.